You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW.
Through each man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver. Have taken from somebody else.
There were some notables in ancient Rome who got the idea that slaves, Roman slaves, should get some visible insignia. They should be made to wear a, whatever it was, a black tunic or some emblem or something, so that slaves could be visible. Because there was a problem with slaves. They mingled in many work sites. You had free labor and slave labor working together, and they would often then, you know, begin to form common sentiments and interests and all that sort of thing. And one of the ways they always tried to distract the plebs, the Roman plebs, the Roman proletariat, was by giving them the fear, spooking them about the slaves. It's a slave, though, the slaves, watch out, you know. Oh, that leader, he's really going to free all the slaves and he'll get you and all that sort of thing. So they, and slaves would often even show up at the forum and shout out at the assembled and all that sort of thing. So they wanted to put the slaves in their place. To put them in their place, they decided they were all going to have to wear a visible uniform of some kind. And then they dropped that idea. Do you know why? Because they realize, they give the slaves this kind of visibility, the slaves themselves will begin to get a sense of their own numbers and strength. Not only will they be visible to us, but they'll be visible to each other. They will find each other. They will see who they are and their numbers. And so we citizens, you know, of whom they would make slaves, and they would, we need to see who we are. We need to see our strength and our numbers, and we just need to see our critical independence of mind and action, for that's what they fear the most, our critical independence of mind and action.
That was Michael Parenti, and this is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Seeing our situation clearly is the first step toward organizing for something different. Understanding how our opinions are shaped is the aim of this week's program, as we focus on the vectors of propaganda and the institutions assigned to disseminate it, beginning in our childhood with the schools, and maintaining the illusion and reinforcing it through adulthood in the media. Like the Roman slaves, those who question the official truth are isolated and come to feel they must be paranoid or mistaken when their reason or observations cause them to notice the divergence between what everybody seems to be saying and what they themselves observe. I'd like to begin the program by reading you an article that illustrates this on several levels. Last April, I aired a program on the death of Corporal Pat Tillman by so-called friendly fire. It was based on excerpts from a congressional hearing and analysis of the evidence presented. Tillman was a pro footballer who turned his back on fame and fortune to enlist in the U.S. Army to fight the war on terrorism in Afghanistan, where he was killed under suspicious circumstances. The administration and the Pentagon initially lied to his family and the public, claiming he'd been killed in battle with the enemy. His family discovered, after the government had used his funeral as a propaganda op, that Tillman had been killed by someone from the American forces, a so-called friendly fire incident. After listening to the testimony, it seemed to me that this was a case of more than the government covering up the accidental death of the Army's most famous recruit. I suggested that what was presented at the hearing testimony raised the question that Tillman was deliberately killed, that his family appeared to believe it, though they did not actually verbalize that accusation during the hearing. And it seems this was indeed the case, as shown by documents that have recently been obtained through a Freedom of Information Act request by the Associated Press. Here's the story AP published on July 26th, written by Martha Mendoza. Army medical examiners were suspicious about the close proximity of the three bullet holes in Pat Tillman's forehead and tried without success to get authorities to investigate whether the former NFL player's death amounted to a crime, according to documents obtained by the Associated Press. The medical evidence did not match up with the scenario as described. A doctor who examined Tillman's body after he was killed on the battlefield in Afghanistan in 2004 told investigators. The doctors, whose names were blacked out, said that the bullet holes were so close together that it appeared the Army Ranger was cut down by an M16 fired from a mere 10 yards or so away. Ultimately, the Pentagon did conduct a criminal investigation and asked Tillman's comrades whether he was disliked by his men and whether they had any reason to believe he was deliberately killed. The Pentagon eventually ruled that Tillman's death at the hands of his comrades was a friendly fire accident. The medical examiner's suspicions were outlined in 2,300 pages of testimony released to the AP this week by the Defense Department in response to a Freedom of Information Act request. Among other information contained in the documents, in his last words moments before he was killed, Tillman snapped at a panicky comrade under fire to shut up and stop sniveling. And Army attorneys sent each other congratulatory emails for keeping criminal investigators at bay as the Army conducted an internal friendly fire investigation that resulted in administrative or non-criminal punishments. And that the three-star general who kept the truth about Tillman's death from his family and the public told investigators some 70 times that he had a bad memory and couldn't recall the details of his actions, and that no evidence at all of enemy fire was found at the scene. No one was hit by enemy fire, nor was any government equipment struck. The Pentagon and Bush administration have been criticized in recent months for lying about the circumstances of Tillman's death. The military initially told the public and the Tillman family that he had been killed by enemy fire. Only weeks later did the Pentagon acknowledge he was gunned down by fellow Rangers. With questions lingering about how high in the Bush administration the deception reached, Congress is preparing for yet another hearing next week. The Pentagon is separately preparing a new round of punishments, including a stinging demotion of retired Lieutenant General Philip R. Kenzinger, according to military officials who spoke on condition of anonymity, because the punishments under consideration have not been made public. In more than 4 hours of questioning by the Pentagon Inspector General's office in 2006, Kenzinger repeatedly contradicted other officers' testimony and sometimes his own. He said on some 70 occasions that he did not recall something. At one point he said, "You've got me really scared about my brain right now. I'm really having a problem," unquote. Tillman's mother, Mary Tillman, who has long suggested that her son was deliberately killed by his comrades, said she is still looking for answers and looks forward to the congressional hearings next week. "Nothing is going to bring Pat back. It's about justice for Pat and justice for other soldiers. The nation has been deceived," she said. The documents show that a doctor who autopsied Tillman's body was suspicious of the three gunshot wounds to the forehead. The doctor said he took the unusual step of calling the Army's Human Resources Command and was rebuffed. He then asked an official in the Army's Criminal Investigation Division if the CID would consider opening a criminal case. He said he talked to his higher headquarters and they said no, the doctor testified. Also, according to the documents, investigators pressed officers and soldiers on a question Ms. Tillman has been asking all along. Have you ever received any information, even rumor, that Corporal Tillman was killed by anybody within his own unit intentionally? An investigator asked then Captain Richard Scott. Scott and others who were asked said they were certain the shooting was accidental. Investigators also asked soldiers and commanders whether Tillman was disliked, whether anyone was jealous of his celebrity, or if he was considered arrogant. They said Tillman was respected, admired, and well-liked. The documents also shed new light on Tillman's last moments. It has been widely reported by the AP and others that Specialist Brian O'Neill, who was at Tillman's side as he was killed, told investigators that Tillman was waving his arms, shouting, "Cease fire, friendlies, I am Pat, expletive, Tillman, damn it," again and again. But the latest documents give a different account from a chaplain who debriefed the entire unit days after Tillman was killed. The chaplain said that O'Neill told him he was hugging the ground at Tillman's side, crying out, "God help us." And Tillman says to him, "Would you shut your expletive mouth? God's not going to help you. You need to do something for yourself, you sniveling." Dot, dot, dot. And that's how the AP story ends. The way a news story ends, the last word, what it is and who has said it, is always significant, as that's the impression the writer wants to leave you with. What are they conveying here? That Tillman was an atheist jerk and deserved to die? That an angry Christian killed him? That O'Neill is a suspect? Certainly that he's a liar. I'm not sure, but another report on this same issue published in Editor and Publisher ends with the statement that Tillman's fellow soldiers testified that he was well-liked, which is reported several paragraphs back in the AP article. What both of the articles suggest, however, is that if Tillman was murdered, it would be a matter of personal dislike. What neither of the articles mentioned was this fact, which has been reported in the independent media, including here, that Tillman had turned against the war, that he had scheduled a meeting with Noam Chomsky during his next leave, and that Tillman's diary, in which he wrote all his thoughts, was inexplicably burned by the military instead of being returned to his family, as is the usual practice with the effects of fallen soldiers. MSNBC's Keith Olbermann, who's known for going where others fear to tread, took on the political angle of the Tillman case during his program Countdown this week. Here's the audio of his interview on July 27th.
Another scandal was already due to ripen with congressional hearings next week. The friendly fire death of football star turned Army Ranger Corporal Pat Tillman. Then came the military records obtained by the Associated Press through the Freedom of Information Act that military officials initially blocked investigators from probing whether Tillman's death was not friendly fire at all, but perhaps murder. The request for a murder investigation came from Army medical examiners suspicious about the tight grouping of the three bullet holes in Pat Tillman's forehead. All were within a 2-inch diameter, suggesting the M16 that killed him was fired from perhaps just 30 feet away. CID, the Army's Criminal Investigation Division, refused to look into it. Only later did a criminal probe rule Tillman's death friendly fire. No evidence was found that anybody but Americans fired shots on that day, April 22, 2004, in Afghanistan. The Army knew almost immediately he had been killed by one of his own, but it did not drop its story of enemy fire until 5 weeks later, a week after Tillman's death. A top general had urged the head of Central Command to tell President Bush that Tillman might have been killed by friendly fire. And 2 days later, Mr. Bush referred to Tillman's death in a speech, but avoided any mention of how he died. The White House is refusing to turn over some of its internal records about Mr. Tillman, including Mr. Bush's draft versions of his speech. Let's turn now to John Soltz, veteran of the Iraq War, chairman of VoteVets.org. John, thanks for your time tonight.
Thanks for having me, sir.
First, as a combat Army veteran, what does it tell you when you hear no enemy shots fired, three bullet holes, extraordinarily tight grouping to the forehead?
It tells me the first investigation was a lie. It tells me the second investigation is a lie. He wasn't killed marching up a hill and earning a Silver Star against the Afghan fighters. He wasn't killed by a Humvee and a squad automatic weapon from 150 meters away waving his hands. That he was either killed through homicide or negligent homicide. And obviously the difference there is, was it an accidental discharge of someone next to him? But this administration has their hands on a lie, and they need to come forward and tell the truth for our soldiers and for the family.
Corporal Tillman held a number of personal views that were unpopular within the context of the Bush administration, if perhaps also within the Army. He reportedly favored John Kerry in that election that year. We know he opposed the invasion of Iraq. He thought it illegal. He had plans to meet with Noam Chomsky. The Associated Press told us in its report last night that during the firefight, a fellow soldier was hugging the ground, crying out to God, and Tillman said, let me quote this directly, "Would you shut your expletive-deleted mouth? God's not going to help you. You need to do something for yourself, you sniveling," and that's all the quote was. That was apparently at the last moment of his life. Explain how all of those details intensify the need for openness here that we're not getting now.
Well, obviously, the White House is, you know, has this executive privilege. For some reason, they don't want to be honest to a family or to our country of a soldier that died in war. And we know Pat Tillman was against the war in Iraq. He signed up for Afghanistan. We know he was a free thinker. But it leads you to think, was this guy killed possibly by people that didn't like his political views? Or was he killed accidentally? And we had a time of the war when we had the Abu Ghraib scandal that broke in April 2004 in Iraq. We had basically the Iraqi, you know, Tet Offensive, as we refer to it, where the Shia militias rose up and the contractors were burned to the stake. And the president was facing re-election. He decided not to go into Fallujah for 6 months. And did they use him to justify politically bad policy in Iraq? And until they tell us the truth, they're only hurting themselves, and they're hurting the family, and they're hurting the military by not telling us the truth. But this is the time for openness. If they use them for a political ploy, the President of the United States is disgraceful.
John, we know, speaking of the Tillman family, we know their own investigation, the results of that, conflicts to some degree with some of the findings that were cited in this Associated Press report last night. But whatever the precise facts turn out to be on the broader scale, what is the message sent to current troops and prospective recruits from the way this has been handled so far in the 3 years and a few months since it happened?
I think for the Army, this is so important. I'll never forget where I was. I was in Germany. I opened up the Stars and Stripes, and I saw that an NFL football player, Pat Tillman, was going to leave the NFL, leave the pop glory of our country, and be one of us. It was just a tremendous honor. I'll never forget where I was when I read, I was on a computer lab in graduate school, and I read that Pat Tillman was killed. And he made people want to be a soldier. He made us feel great about ourselves. And we rely on families and people who have family members to help enlist our troops into the military. And when a recruiter walks into a home and they ask the mother and father to give their 18-year-old to fight for our country, that mother and father is going to sit there and they're going to say, hey, you know, can I trust that you guys are going to tell me how my son or daughter dies? It decimates our recruiting abilities, and it's the fault of our president.
John Soltz, veteran of the Iraq War, now chairman of VoteVets.org. As always, John, great thanks for your service, and great thanks for your service here.
That a clip of Keith Olbermann from the MSNBC program Countdown. Olbermann, who was perhaps the most openly critical news anchor on corporate-owned media, is extremely popular. He serves as a demonstration that the pro-administration bias in the media is not a response to viewer preference. Olbermann's popularity, as well as comedians like Jon Stewart, demonstrates that the media has been largely refusing to give a large audience what they want. Why not? Because these media organizations are part of a propaganda system that is used to create and enforce a particular social consensus. And to make those swimming against the tide feel like they are isolated, few, and weak in a way analogous to the situation of the Roman slaves described in the Michael Parenti clip at the top of the show. Next, we're going to hear from John Pilger, an Australian journalist and documentary filmmaker with a prodigious body of work and a long list of awards. His latest book is called Freedom Next Time, and he spoke last month in Chicago on how propaganda and the press are used to create an invisible government.
Well, the title of this talk is Freedom Next Time, which, of course, is the title of the book. And the book is meant as an antidote to the propaganda that's so often disguised as journalism. And so I thought I would talk today about journalism, about war by journalism, propaganda, and silence, and how that silence might be broken. Edward Bernays, the so-called father of public relations, wrote about an invisible government which is the true ruling power of our country. He was referring to journalism, the media. That was almost 80 years ago, not long after corporate journalism was invented. It's a history few journalists talk about or know about, and it began with the arrival of corporate advertising. As the new corporations began taking over the press, something called professional journalism was invented. To attract big advertisers, the new corporate press had to appear respectable, pillars of the establishment, objective, impartial, balanced. The first schools of journalism were set up, and a mythology of liberal neutrality was spun around the professional journalist. The right to freedom of expression was associated with the new media and with the great corporations, and the whole thing was, as Robert McChesney put it so well, entirely bogus. For what the public didn't know was that in order to be professional, journalists had to ensure that news and opinion were dominated by official sources. And that hasn't changed. Go through the New York Times on any day and check the sources of the main political stories, domestic and foreign. You'll find they're dominated by governments and other establishment interests. That's the essence of professional journalism. I'm not suggesting that independent journalism was or is excluded, but it's more likely to be an honourable exception. Think of the role Judith Miller played in the New York Times in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq. Yes, her work became a scandal, but only after it had played a powerful role in promoting an invasion based on lies. But Miller's parroting of official sources and vested interests was not all that different from the work of many famous Times reporters, such as the celebrated W.H. Lawrence, who helped cover up the true effects of the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima in August 1945. "No radioactivity in Hiroshima ruin," was the headline on his report, and it was false. Consider how the power of this invisible government has grown. In 1983, the principal global media was owned by 50 corporations, most of them American. In 2002, this had fallen to just 9 corporations. Today, it's probably about 5. Rupert Murdoch has predicted that there will be just 3 global media giants, and his company will be one of them. This concentration of power is not exclusive, of course, to the United States. The BBC has announced it's expanding its broadcasts to the United States because it believes Americans want principled, objective, neutral journalism, for which the BBC is famous. They've launched BBC America. You may have seen the advertising. The BBC began in 1922, just before the corporate press began in America. Its founder was Lord John Reith, who believed that impartiality and objectivity were the essence of professionalism. In the same year, the British establishment was under siege. The unions had called a general strike, and the Tories were terrified that a revolution was on the way. The new BBC came to their rescue. In high secrecy, Lord Reith wrote anti-union speeches for the Tory Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin and broadcast them to the nation, while refusing to allow the Labour leaders to put their side until the strike was over. So a pattern was set. Impartiality was a principle to be suspended whenever the establishment was under threat. And that principle has been upheld ever since. Take the invasion of Iraq. There are two studies of the BBC's reporting. One shows that the BBC gave just 2% of its coverage of Iraq to anti-war dissent. 2%. That's less than the anti-war coverage of ABC, NBC, and CBS. A second study by the University of Wales shows that in the build-up to the invasion, 90% of the BBC's references to weapons of mass destruction suggested that Saddam Hussein actually possessed them, and that by clear implication, Bush and Blair were right. We now know that the BBC and other British media were used by the Secret Intelligence Service, MI6, in what they called Operation Mass Appeal. MI6 agents planted stories about Saddam's weapons of mass destruction, such as weapons hidden in his palaces and in secret underground bunkers. All these stories were fake. But that's not the point. The point is that the work of MI6 was unnecessary, because professional journalism on its own would have produced the same result. Listen to the BBC's man in Washington, Matt Fry, shortly after the invasion. "There is no doubt," he told viewers in the UK and all over the world, "that the desire to bring good, to bring American values to the rest of the world, and especially now in the Middle East, is now increasingly tied up with American military power." In 2005, the same reporter lauded the architect of the invasion, Paul Wolfowitz, as someone who believes passionately in the power of democracy and grassroots development. That was before the little incident at the World Bank. None of this is unusual. BBC News routinely describes the invasion as a miscalculation, not illegal, not unprovoked, not based on lies, but a miscalculation. The words mistake and blunder are common BBC News currency, along with failure, which at least suggests that if the deliberate, calculated, unprovoked, illegal assault on defenseless Iraq had succeeded, that would have been just fine. Whenever I hear these words, I think of Edward Herman's marvelous essay about normalizing the unthinkable. For that's what media cliched language does and is designed to do. It normalizes the unthinkable of the degradation of war, of severed limbs, of maimed children, all of which I've seen. One of my favorite stories about the Cold War concerns a group of Russian journalists who were touring the United States. On the final day of their visit, they were asked by their hosts for their impressions. "I have to tell you," said the spokesman, "that we were astonished to find, after reading all the newspapers and watching TV day after day, that all the opinions on all the vital issues are the same. To get that result in our country, we send journalists to the gulag. We even tear out their fingernails. Here, you don't have to do any of that. What's the secret?" Oh. What is the secret? It's a question seldom asked in newsrooms, in media colleges, in journalism journals. And yet the answer to that question is critical to the lives of millions of people. On August the 24th last year, the New York Times declared this in an editorial: "If we had known then what we know now, the invasion of Iraq would have been stopped by a popular outcry." Unquote. This amazing admission was saying, in effect, that journalists had betrayed the public by not doing their job and by accepting and amplifying and echoing the lives of Bush and his gang instead of challenging and exposing them. What the Times didn't say was that had that paper and the rest of the media exposed the lies, up to 1 million people might be alive today. That's the belief now of a number of senior establishment journalists. Few of them, they've spoken to me about it, few of them will say it in public. Ironically, I began to understand how censorship worked in so-called free societies when I reported from totalitarian societies. During the 1970s, I filmed secretly in Czechoslovakia, then a Stalinist dictatorship. I interviewed members of the dissident group Charter 77, including the novelist Zenady Urbanek, and this is what he told me. I quote him. In dictatorships, we are more fortunate than you in the West in one respect. We believe nothing of what we read in the newspapers and nothing of what we watch on television because we know it's propaganda and lies. Unlike you in the West, we've learned to look behind the propaganda and to read between the lines. Unlike you, we know that the real truth is always subversive. Vandana Shiva has called this subjugated knowledge. The great Irish muckraker Claude Coben got it right when he wrote, "Never believe anything until it's officially denied." One of the oldest clichés of war is that truth is the first casualty. No, it's not. Journalism is the first casualty. When the Vietnam War was over, the magazine Encounter published an article by Robert Elegant, a distinguished correspondent who had covered the war. "For the first time in modern history," he wrote, "the outcome of a war was determined not on the battlefield, but on the printed page, and above all, on the television screen." He held journalists responsible for losing the war by opposing it in their reporting. Robert Elegant's view became the received wisdom in Washington, and it still is. In Iraq, the Pentagon invented the embedded journalist because it believed that critical reporting had lost Vietnam. The very opposite was true. On my first day as a young reporter in Saigon, I called at the bureaus of the main newspapers and TV companies. I noticed that some of them had a pinboard on the wall on which were gruesome photographs, mostly of bodies of Vietnamese and of American soldiers holding up severed ears and testicles. In one office was a photograph of a man being tortured. Above the torturer's head was a stick-on comic balloon with the words, "That'll teach you to talk to the press." None of these pictures were ever published or even put on the wire. I asked why. I was told that the public would never accept them. Anyway, to publish them would not be objective or impartial. At first, I accepted the apparent logic of this. I, too, had grown up on stories of the good war against Germany and Japan, that ethical bath that cleansed the Anglo-American world of all evil. But the longer I stayed in Vietnam, the more I realized that our atrocities were not isolated, nor were they aberrations, that the war itself was an atrocity. That was the big story, and it was seldom news. Yes, the tactics and effectiveness of the military were questioned by some very fine reporters. But the word invasion was never used. The anodyne word used was involved. America was involved in Vietnam. The fiction of a well-intentioned, blundering giant stuck in an Asian quagmire was repeated incessantly. It was left to whistleblowers back home to tell the subversive truth, those like Daniel Ellsberg and Seymour Hersh with his scoop of the My Lai massacre. There were 649 reporters in Vietnam on March the 16th, 1968, the day that the My Lai massacre happened. Not one of them reported it. In both Vietnam and Iraq, deliberate policies and strategies have bordered on genocide. In Vietnam, the forced dispossession of millions of people and the creation of free fire zones. In Iraq, an American enforced embargo that ran through the 1990s like a medieval siege and killed, according to the United Nations Children's Fund, at least 500,000 children under the age of 5. In both Vietnam and Iraq, banned weapons were used against civilians as deliberate experiments. Agent Orange changed the genetic and environmental order in Vietnam. The military called this Operation Hades. When Congress found out, it was renamed the friendlier Operation Ranch Hand, and nothing changed. That's pretty much the way Congress has reacted to the war in Iraq. The Democrats have damned it, rebranded it, and extended it. The Hollywood movies that followed the Vietnam War were an extension of the journalism of normalizing the unthinkable. Yes, some of the movies were critical of the military's tactics, but all of them were careful to concentrate on the angst of the invaders. The first of these movies is now considered a classic. It's The Deer Hunter, whose message was that America had suffered, America was stricken, American boys had done their best against Oriental barbarians. The message was all the more pernicious because The Deer Hunter was brilliantly made and acted. I have to admit it's the only movie that has made me shout out loud in a cinema in protest. Oliver Stone's acclaimed movie, Platoon, was said to be anti-war, and it did show glimpses of the Vietnamese as human beings, but it also promoted, above all, the American invader as victim. I wasn't going to mention the Green Berets when I sat down to write this, until I read the other day that John Wayne was the most influential movie star who ever lived. I saw the Green Berets starring John Wayne on a Saturday night in 1968 in Montgomery, Alabama. I was down there to interview the then infamous governor, George Wallace. And I'd just come back from Vietnam and I couldn't believe how absurd this movie was. So I laughed out loud. I laughed and laughed. And it wasn't long before the atmosphere around me grew very cold. My companion, who'd been a freedom rider in the South, whispered, "Let's get the hell out of here and run like hell." Well, we were chased all the way back to our hotel. But I doubt if any of my pursuers were aware that John Wayne, their hero, had lied so that he wouldn't have to fight in World War II. And yet the phony role model of Wayne sent thousands of young Americans to their deaths in Vietnam, with the notable exceptions of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. Last year, in his acceptance of the Nobel Prize for Literature, the playwright Harold Pinter made an epic speech. He asked why, and I quote him, "The systematic brutality, the widespread atrocities, the ruthless suppression of independent thought in Stalinist Russia were well known in the West, while American state crimes were merely superficially recorded, let alone documented." Unquote. And yet across the world, the extinction and suffering of countless human beings could be attributed to rampant American power. But, said Pinter, you wouldn't know it. It never happened. Nothing ever happened. Even while it was happening, it wasn't happening. It didn't matter. It was of no interest. Unquote. Pinter's words were more than the surreal. The BBC ignored the speech of Britain's greatest dramatist. I've made a number of documentaries about Cambodia. The first was Year Zero, The Silent Death of Cambodia. It describes the American bombing that provided a catalyst for the rise of Pol Pot. What Nixon and Kissinger had started, Pol Pot completed. CIA files alone leave no doubt of that. I offered Year Zero to PBS and took it to Washington. The PBS executives who saw it were shocked. They whispered among themselves. They asked me to wait outside. One of them finally emerged and said, John, we admire your film, but we are disturbed that it says the United States prepared the way for Pol Pot. And I said, well, do you dispute the evidence? I'd quoted a number of CIA documents and others. And, oh, no, he replied. But we've decided to call in a journalistic adjudicator. Now, the term a journalistic adjudicator might have been invented by George Orwell. In fact, they managed to find the only journalist, no, only one of three journalists who'd been invited to Cambodia by Pol Pot. And, of course, he turned his thumbs down on the film, and I never heard from PBS again. Year Zero was broadcast in some 60 countries and became one of the most watched documentaries in the world. It was never shown in the United States. Of the five films I made on Cambodia, one of them was shown by WNET, the PBS station in New York. I believe it was shown at about 1 a.m. On the basis of this single showing, when most people are asleep, it was awarded an Emmy. What marvelous irony. It was worthy of a prize, but not an audience. Harold Pinter's subversive truth, I believe, was that he made the connection between imperialism and fascism and described a battle for history that's almost never reported. This is the great silence of the media age. And this is the secret heart of propaganda today. A propaganda so vast in scope that I'm always astonished that so many Americans know and understand as much as they do. We are talking about a system, of course, not personalities, and yet a great many decent people believe the problem is George W. Bush and his gang. And yes, the Bush gang are extreme, but my experience is that they're no more than an extreme version of what has gone before. In my lifetime, more wars have been started by liberal Democrats than by Republicans. Ignoring this truth is a guarantee that the propaganda system and the war-making system will continue. We've had a branch of the Democratic Party running Britain for the last 10 years. Blair, apparently a liberal, has taken Britain to war more times than any prime minister in the modern era. Yes, his current pal is George Bush, but his first love was Bill Clinton, the most violent president of the 20th century, the late 20th century. Blair's successor, Gordon Brown, is also a devotee of Clinton and Bush. The other day, Brown said, The days of Britain having to apologize for the British Empire are over. We should celebrate. Like Blair, like Clinton, like Bush, Brown believes in the liberal truth that the battle for history has been won, that the millions who died in deliberately imposed famines in British Imperial India will be forgotten, like the millions who have died in the American Empire will be forgotten. And like Blair, his successor is confident that professional journalism is on his side. For most journalists, whether they realize it or not, are groomed to be tribunes of an ideology that regards itself as non-ideological, that presents itself as the natural center, the very fulcrum of civilized modern life. This may well be the most powerful and most dangerous ideology we have ever known, because it's open-ended. This is liberalism. I'm not denying the virtues of liberalism. Far from it. We're all beneficiaries of them. But if we deny its dangers, its open-ended project, and the all-consuming power of its propaganda, then we deny our right to the true democracy, because liberalism and true democracy are not the same. Liberalism began as a cult of the elite in the 19th century, and true democracy is never handed down by elites. It is always fought for and struggled for. A senior member of the anti-war coalition, United for Peace and Justice, said recently, and I quote her, "The Democrats are using the politics of reality," unquote. Her liberal historical reference point was Vietnam. She said that President Johnson began withdrawing troops from Vietnam after a Democratic Congress began to vote against the war. That's not what happened. The troops were withdrawn from Vietnam over four long years, and during that time, the United States killed more people in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos with bombs than were killed in all the preceding years. And that's what's happening in Iraq. The bombing has doubled since last year, and this is not being reported. And who began this bombing? Bill Clinton began it. During the 1990s, Clinton rained bombs on Iraq in what was euphemistically called the no-fly zones. At the same time, he imposed a medieval siege called economic sanctions, killing, as I've mentioned, perhaps a million people, including the documented figure of 500,000 children. Almost none of this carnage was reported in the so-called mainstream media. Last year, a study by the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health found that since the invasion of Iraq, 655,000 Iraqis had died as a direct result of the invasion. Official documents show that the Blair government knew this figure to be credible. In February, Les Roberts, the author of the report, said the figure was equal, to the figure of deaths in the Fordham University study of the Rwandan genocide. The media response to Robert's shocking revelation was silence. What may well be the greatest episode of organized killing for a generation, in Harold Pinter's words, did not happen. It didn't matter. Many people who regard themselves on the left supported Bush's attack on Afghanistan. That the CIA had supported Osama bin Laden was ignored, that the Clinton administration had secretly backed the Taliban, even giving them high-level briefings of the CIA, is virtually unknown in the United States. The Taliban were secret partners with the oil giant Unocal in building an oil pipeline across Afghanistan. And when a Clinton official was reminded that the Taliban persecuted women, he said, "We can live with that." There is compelling evidence that Bush decided to attack Afghanistan not as a result of 9/11, but 2 months earlier in July 2001. This is virtually unknown in the United States, publicly, like the scale of civilian casualties in Afghanistan. To my knowledge, only one mainstream reporter, Jonathan Steele of The Guardian in London, has investigated civilian casualties in Afghanistan. His estimate is 20,000 dead civilians, and that was 3 years ago. The enduring tragedy of Palestine is due in great part, to the silence and compliance of the so-called liberal left. Hamas is described repeatedly as sworn to the destruction of Israel. The New York Times, Associated Press, the Boston Globe, take your pick. They'll all use this line as a standard disclaimer, and it's false. That Hamas has called for a 10-year ceasefire is almost never reported. Even more important, that Hamas has undergone an historic ideological shift in the last few years, which amounts to a recognition of what it calls the reality of Israel, is virtually unknown. And that Israel is sworn to the destruction of Palestine is unspeakable. There is a pioneering study done by Glasgow University on the reporting of Palestine. They interviewed young people who watched TV news in Britain. More than 90% thought the illegal settlers were Palestinian. The more they watched, the less they knew, in Danny Schechter's famous phrase. The current most dangerous silence is over nuclear weapons and the return of the Cold War. The Russians understand clearly that the so-called American defense shield in Eastern Europe is designed to subjugate and humiliate them. Yet the front pages here talk about Putin starting a new Cold War, and there is silence about the development of an entirely new American nuclear system called Reliable Weapons Replacement, RRW, which is designed to blur the distinction between conventional war and nuclear war, a long-held ambition. In the meantime, Iran is being softened up, with the liberal media playing almost the same role it played before the Iraq invasion. And as for the Democrats, look at how Barack Obama has become the voice of the Council on Foreign Relations, one of the propaganda organs of the old liberal Washington establishment. Obama writes that he wants the troops home, and I quote, "We must not rule out military force against long-standing adversaries such as Iran and Syria," unquote. Listen to this from the liberal Obama, and I quote, "At moment of great peril in the past century, our leaders ensured that America, by deed and by example, led and lifted the world, that we stood for and fought for the freedom sought by billions of people beyond our borders," unquote. You know, that's the nub of the propaganda, the brainwashing, if you like, that seeps into the lives of every American, and many of us who are not Americans. From right to left, secular to God-fearing. What so few people know is that in the last half century, United States administrations have overthrown 50 governments, many of them democracies. In the process, 30 countries have been attacked and bombed, with the loss of countless lives. Bush bashing is all very well and is justified. But the moment we begin to accept the siren call of the Democrats' drivel about standing up and fighting for freedom sought by billions, the battle for history is lost and we ourselves are silenced. So what should we do? That question, often asked in meetings I've addressed, even meetings as informed as those in this conference, is itself interesting. It's my experience that people in the so-called third world rarely ask the question because they know what to do. And some have paid with their freedom and their lives, but they knew what to do. It's a question that many on the democratic left, small d, have yet to answer. Real information, subversive information, remains the most potent power of all, and I believe we must not fall into the trap of believing that the media speaks for the public. That wasn't true in Stalinist Czechoslovakia, and it isn't true in Bush's United States. In all the years I've been a journalist, I've never known public consciousness to have risen as fast as it's rising today. Yes, its direction and shape is unclear, partly because people are now deeply suspicious of political alternatives and because the Democratic Party has succeeded in seducing and dividing the electoral left. And yet this growing critical public awareness is all the more remarkable when you consider the sheer scale of indoctrination, the mythology of a superior way of life, and the current manufactured state of fear. Why did the New York Times come clean in that editorial last year? Not because it opposes Bush's wars. Look at the coverage of Iran. That editorial was a rare acknowledgement that the public were beginning to see the concealed role of the media, that people were beginning to read between the lines. If Iran is attacked, the reaction and the upheaval cannot be predicted. The National Security and Homeland Security Presidential Directive gives Bush power over all facets of government in an emergency. It's not unlikely the Constitution will be suspended, the laws to round up hundreds of thousands of so-called terrorists and enemy combatants are already on the books. That's not paranoia, to be understanding of that. I believe that these dangers are understood by the public, who have come a long way since 9/11, and a long way since the propaganda that linked Saddam Hussein to Al-Qaeda. That's why they voted for the Democrats last November, only to be betrayed. But they need truth. And journalists ought to be agents of truth, not the courtiers of power. I believe a fifth estate is possible, the product of a people's movement that monitors, deconstructs, and counters the media, the corporate media. In every university, in every media college, in every newsroom, teachers of journalism and journalists themselves need to ask themselves about the part they now play in the bloodshed in the name of a bogus objectivity. Such a movement within the media could herald a perestroika of a kind we've never known. This is all possible. Silences can be broken. In Britain, the National Union of Journalists has undergone a radical change and has called for a boycott of Israel. The website... The website medialens.org has single-handedly called the BBC to account. In the United States, wonderfully free, rebellious spirits populate the web. I can't mention them all here, but from Tom Feely's International Clearinghouse to Mike Albert's ZNet to Counterpunch Online and the splendid work of FAIR. The best reporting of Iraq appears on the web. Darja Miles, courageous journalism... And citizen reporters like Joe Wilding, who reported the siege of Fallujah from inside the city. In Venezuela, Greg Wilpert's investigations turned back much of the virulent propaganda now aimed at Hugo Chavez. Make no mistake, it's the threat of freedom of speech for the majority in Venezuela